from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Summer at the Palladium now through August.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli-Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Late August, and once again, it's time for the annual Indie Fringe Theater Festival. Today, I'll find out about the intimate opera at the Indie Fringe and chat with Lou Harry about his play in this year's Fringe. Plus, I'll get a preview of the Midwest Garden Writers Conference.
So a bit of Fringe and Ferns for our All Sharon show. Of course, we'll also have our arts calendar that we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
Intimate Opera is a new company founded to take advantage of small performing spaces and to produce underperformed, staged music with local talent. The company is producing Mozart's The Impresario during the Indie Fringe Festival. And Sharon invited Amy Hayes and Sean Manterfield in to learn more about the company and its goals.
All right, these are two words you don't always find together, intimate and opera. Explain. Amy, Sean, whoever wants to take this.
Well, it's something I had been thinking about for a long time, obviously, because I've been doing this, well, since I could sing.
Which is, how far back does this go?
Oh, since I was 3.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the way my mother could keep track of me when I was in a store. So just keep talking to me. And so I would sing for her. And I started opera in high school. I started with the Indianapolis Opera in the chorus when I graduated from college, which was about 5-6 years ago. And I remember being in the chorus thinking, I can't even see the audience, or I have an idea. This would be a really interesting idea at this moment. But, you know, your job is to move where they tell you and to sing what they tell you to sing and look the way you're supposed to look. And I thought, I could really see people coming to a show if they wanted, if they could see me and talk to me and see that I was a real person and not be intimidated by opera. So I got talking with my friend Larry in the church parking lot after choir rehearsal one night. And he said, I have had this idea. I have had this idea. Let's do it. So and that was about 8 months ago, 9 months. So,
What was the next step?
Picking a name. So if we're going to be an opera company, we need to have a name. And Indianapolis Opera was already taken. I had had an idea about guerrilla opera, not like the animal, but like going out on the street and just singing
Surprise,
opera.
Sneak attacks
Flash to people. Mom. And there was already an opera company in Massachusetts that had that name. So, that's really unfortunate. So we got talking, and every descriptor we would use was intimate. So, well, let's just call ourselves that. So I started looking and seeing if there was another opera company, and there was nobody that I could find. So we came up with that, made up the website, and got the name. And now we find out there are two other opera companies with intimate opera, one in Chicago and one in Pasadena, California. But we got intimateopera.org, so we're happy.
Well done.
Yeah.
And you're the only intimate opera of Indianapolis.
That's right. That's right.
So defining terms, your preference will be to perform in smaller venues that are more intimate. So rather than in Clues Hall, where there might be 2,200 people watching and there's just a mass of humanity on stage between the chorus and large sets and so forth, you're going to be in smaller spaces, as you'll be during the Fringe in Cook Theater at the new Indiana Landmark Center, which has, by the way, fabulous acoustics, as I'm sure you know.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Wonderful.
Yeah. How does being intimate opera inform your choice of repertoire?
Well, we have almost the entire repertoire to pick from, because in Indianapolis Opera, I love, can do all the grand operas. Doing Turandot at the Indie Fringe Theater would really just not do it justice, nor would we want to attempt something like that. So we tend to do shorter operas, things that are very accessible, a lot of comedy, things that are intended to be chamber pieces,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of modern things. In January, we're going to do two Ned Roram pieces.
Love Ned Roram, and he has, of course, an Indiana connection.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we have everything to choose from. We can choose from Baroque to composers who are still alive,
mm-hmm.
and it's just trying to decide what we want to do, because we have so many choices, a lot of choices that people don't even realize are out there. They hear, well, we're doing Mozart as our first piece, which is accessible. People like Mozart,
mm-hmm.
People like comedy, and there's some dialogue in it, so it's a little more like a musical theater for people who want to come see an opera. But we also plan to do actual full operas the way they were intended to be done for small houses.
Let's talk about instrumentalists then.
uh-huh.
I'm looking at the person who is not only a singer but also a keyboardist. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What are your plans? Are you going to hire freelancers around town and do a pickup ensemble for your instrumentalists?
It depends on. Right now, we've talked about the possibility of down the road actually hiring a small chamber ensemble,
mm-hmm.
because with piano it's one thing, but if you have a piano and a string quartet, for instance, it automatically brings the music that much more alive.
Right.
And that's something that is down the road. But for now, I was actually initially contacted because I was a pianist,
mm-hmm.
and I had a good friend who I sing with who said, well, I have a friend who is a, because they were looking for a pianist.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I have a friend who's a pianist and he's a baritone. And so I was
two for
brought
one.
On and now
deal.
Actually just the way it's worked out in this performance, I'm going to be both playing a role and playing the piano. Same show. And it works out well for this. That's something that we probably will not do too much of in the future.
No, not with Roram, at least.
No.
How did you get started both with piano and with singing?
Well, my mother was a vocal performance major in college, and so when I was little, all of my siblings, we had to learn an instrument of some sort. And so when I was four, I started playing piano. And then I've sung as long as I can remember. And when I turned eight, it was foretold when I was born that I was going to be singing in the Men and Boys Choir at Christ Church Cathedral.
Great
and
training.
And so I've sung there my whole life, and I've recently rejoined the choir after coming back from a master's degree. So,
you know, it just hit me. We could put your two beginnings together and stage some sort of flash mob for you. You could, you know, take a portable keyboard into a grocery store.
Absolutely.
And
uh-huh.
you can sing across the store.
That my mother knows
where
I am.
Your parents would be so proud.
Exactly.
Yes, very much so.
Little did they know that going to the grocery store was my first training.
talk about what do you mean by opera on demand?
Well, that was our very first show. It was about 2 weeks ago. And we said, well, what does everybody know?
Hmm.
It was more of a cabaret show. Let's just put down everything that we know. And what people want to hear, they tell us. That's what they'll maybe shout out. Nobody ended up shouting
Fizzy
out.
Fizzy D'Arte. Uh-huh.
I did get a lot of requests like, do you know the quartet from Faust? It's like, that's kind of hard to put together on the spot.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm pretty decent at sight reading, but not that good. So we just had a whole list of things. And Danielle, one of the other singers, she could have had a whole show just of herself. She had so much material. And you know, it was sit around, drinks, cocktails, sushi, and some desserts, and a piano and singing.
Did it work the way you anticipated it to work? Other than the few wild card yowza, we
can't
do that.
Yes and no. I mean, it was funny because the original idea was to have it so that, you know, it's kind of the way opera originally was, which was people talking and having a good time while mm-hmm. people are singing. But now we're such...
We're
you
know, so trained.
We're so trained as Western audiences that as soon as we started singing, everyone turned and sat quietly and listened.
And holding their hands.
Yes.
And put on their best manners.
Well, when we did our dress rehearsal, I told everybody, so please talk so that we can try and help the people who come to the show know that it's okay to talk during the show. And I got some really dirty looks from people. I'm like, hey, wait a second. I put this together. You can't give me a dirty look.
You know, it is an interesting cultural phenomenon. It spilled over, I don't know, are you jazz fans at all?
Yeah.
Somewhat, yeah.
It mm-hmm. spilled over. You go to a lot of jazz clubs now, and as soon as the music starts, yeah. everybody mm-hmm. shuts up mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, wow. It's like everybody sees feast or famine, black or white. There's right. only one way mm-hmm. to be an audience.
Right.
Well, if you look at the origins of opera, I mean, especially with, you know, Baroque opera in particular, if you go to one now, it seems kind of boring. And that's because...
That's because all you're doing is staring at the stage.
Yeah, and back then they would be talking and gambling and having a great time.
Feasting.
And then all of a sudden mm-hmm. when it comes to the time for the singer to show off, everyone yeah. would be quiet and watch that. And then they were done and everyone would go back to having a good time.
Well, and people would see these operas over and over and over again. Like some people go to movies. Some people can't imagine going to a movie again. I can. I see the same movie over and over again. We have our favorite movies. I don't need to sit down and watch the entire thing. I'll tune in for the moments that I really, really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it started off with opera. People would draw the curtains in their boxes, and then the parts that they wanted, they'd open them back up. And then when it was done, it's like, oh, this is boring. I'm going to close it again. But and that's kind of why we did the show that we're doing, is we want to keep everything within the movie time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
the amount of time and effort that you would go into going to a movie, that's what you would do for our show as well.
Mm-hmm. You're not consigning your entire Friday night or whatever.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. If you want to go to, you know, brunch and then come to our matinee, you're going to be out before dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I promise.
So let's talk about your fringe shows. What are you going to be doing? And speaking of shorter shows.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're doing The Impresario by Mozart. And it really will run about 45 minutes, and it is something that you can easily go to and just enjoy. And it's a very silly show. It's intended to mock opera.
Yes. Is it early or late in his career?
It's late. It's one of the last things that he did.
Yeah, it was written in the same year as The Marriage of Figaro.
Okay.
And it is the exact opposite, I would say, of almost every show that he has. This
mm-hmm.
this version is not the version that he wrote. It had many, many more characters, and it was intended to be part of a festival. It was a competition,
okay.
like it was a competition between him and Salieri. So if you can imagine from the movie Amadeus,
yeah.
it's somewhat of a competition, and it was kind of the extra piece to Salieri's piece.
Okay.
And
I'm guessing there's a lot of showing off in it.
There is. And it starts off with the impresario of the show, and he's trying to get out of the show. He wants to get out and go off and retire, and they keep pulling him back in with all of the mm-hmm. drama. And it was intended that a bunch of actors would come on, and they would do famous monologues from other shows at the time, other theater pieces. And then the singers would come in at the very end, and they would do their parts. Well, now it's just condensed down to just the singing parts, which is fine because...
Because we're intimate opera.
Yes,
<That's right.
laughs> it's opera, not intimate theater.
Acting, right.
Exactly. And so it makes a little bit of sense. The plot is much easier to understand. It's this very simple plot.
And it's been modernized as well. We've changed it so that it's more accessible to modern audiences.
Yeah.
Because if you did a direct word-for-word translation of the original
yeah.
German, it wouldn't really follow too well.
Be like, this is comedy.
But everyone understands the premise. I mean, you have an agent coming with a soprano at the end of her career and a soprano at the beginning of her career who don't know about the other.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
And then, of course, they find out about the other... And
hilarity ensues.
That may be
there's a lot of really great music. It's one of the best written pieces, in my opinion. That it's silly, it makes fun of opera, but in a kind way. Like
mm-hmm.
it's endearing comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I really love this art form so much, but it's not really, we're not going to take it that seriously.
Has it ever been performed here? Have you found any evidence?
It's performed often in universities,
colleges,
but
yeah.
I have not heard that it has been performed here. And one of the reasons why we wanted to start this company is the only opera that I ever really hear about, other than Clues, is every once in a while somebody will do a Mall and the Night Visitors during Christmas.
Right.
And that's, I love them all, but there are a lot more operas out there
right.
than them all. And so.
Quick question about, we talked about translation a moment ago. Is your preference going down the road to mostly do English translations or?
We do, a lot of the pieces that I personally am drawn to are American operas.
Okay.
But I have, I also would like to do maybe a Handel or Monteverdi. Mm-hmm. Handel that's like, that's condensed down to the best parts. I don't want to sing for 4 hours. I'm just telling you right now. I'm not going to sing for 4 hours, and it's a lot. It's a lot of music.
Mm-hmm, right.
And we would consider doing it in Italian,
mm-hmm.
Because we have the freedom to really act. We right. can. It's not just standing and singing. It's not park and bark. So. I did not come up with that. I will be honest that I did not come up with it. I wish I had. That would have been great.
All right. So since we're talking about that, I'm putting in a request right now. It has been a long, long time since anyone did Coronation of Poppaea.
That's what I want to do.
All right.
That's funny because
and the last time it was done at the Old Centrum, mm-hmm. long before Indiana Landmarks acquired it, and with Mr. Cook and family.
Mm-hmm.
Made
yes.
it into the beautiful venue it is now.
Mm-hmm. That's funny because I just recently received my master's at Bowling Green State University,
mm-hmm.
and last fall we did the Impresario, and the spring before that they did the Coronation of Poppaea.
These pieces are following you around.
Yes.
I know.
It's a sign. It's a sign.
Sharon Gamble with soprano Amy Hayes and baritone and pianist Sean Manterfield. Learn more about intimate opera and their performances of Mozart's The Impresario during Indie Fringe at intimateopera.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
What if you built a beer can raft and took a nap on it, only to wake up miles from home with your best and worst friends by your side? Beer Can Raft, a collection of related short plays by Lou Harry, is being directed by Karen Irwin for this year's Indie Fringe Festival. Sharon Gamble invited Lou and Karen to talk about the collaboration between writer and director and what makes for a good fringe show.
Well, let's start with the title. Lou, I'm asking you because you're the writer.
Wow. Beer Can Raft. It is catchy, isn't it?
It very much is.
The title made sense for a play. One of the plays in this is set on a beer can raft.
It's a collection.
In a way, it started out as two separate plays that I didn't think had anything to do with each other.
Did you write them for Fringe?
No, not originally. The whole package is for Fringe. Mm-hmm. One piece, actually, I wrote kind of on a semi-dare, and it was performed, I don't even think Karen knows this, it was performed as part of a trilogy with two other writers at a high school in northern Indiana. Okay, so it was written for high school students.
Wait, this wasn't an Eric Pfeffinger?
No, nothing.
No, okay.
Nothing to do with Eric.
Okay.
Nothing to do with Eric, who I've collaborated with on some other projects. So there was that, and that kind of hovered out there. And then I wrote another piece.
Wait, which one was that?
That was Beer Can Raft.
Oh, very nice.
An earlier version of Beer Can Raft. And then there's another piece called Predictable that I wrote, and two actor friends kind of developed and workshopped. But then as we were talking about what we might do for Fringe, and Karen asked me if I had something that was producible for her to direct, these two pieces and some other ones that I tried to put together started to make sense together.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have, in a way, are three kind of standalone plays and a fourth one that puts the other three in a different context.
Okay. Is there an ensemble cast that is linked through all of
yes.
this?
Cool.
Yes. Four people playing multiple roles. And actually, that's one of the things that Karen brought to the table as a director. It was great to have somebody looking at the material, pushing it, prodding it, seeing what it could become. And it was originally written for three people. And she made it a more balanced four, and I think it works much better that way.
How did you first encounter each other's work? And have you worked together before?
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Each other's work. I did his oldest daughter's bat mitzvah?
Yes, as a karaoke artist.
Okay.
That was part of it. But you also did a reading. When I had a book launch a couple years ago of a novel of mine that was published.
Was this the
High Impact Infidelity Diet?
Yeah. Okay.
And that was co-written with Eric Pfeffinger.
Right.
There we go.
And we decided to have instead of the traditional bookstore reading by the boring authors, I decided to invite some actors to read some of the monologues from the piece. And it turned into a wonderful event. Karen just did a great job with it. And so that and seeing her in many, many productions around Indianapolis build a connection there.
Karen, I know you're doing more directing. You've done directing through the years, although most people know you from your onstage work. You have a new company that launched recently.
Not mine.
You're involved.
But I actually directed their inaugural production of Betty Rage Productions, inaugural production. That's actually Callie Burke and Lacey Meyer that started that company and pulled me in for that first show.
What is it? How is it different being a director than an actor?
It's entirely different. There's more control in some ways and a lot less in others. You know?
Say more about that. I want to know.
Well, I don't even really fancy myself a director, quite frankly. I've been struggling with even that word, which is to say, I consider myself more of a troubleshooter.
Okay.
So I've got four fabulous actors. Like, excitingly fabulous actors.
Who are they?
They are Georgiana Smith, Matt Goodrich, Spencer Elliott, and Julie Morrow. And they all have incredible instincts and just automatically are, you know, fearless and do interesting things. And then when it doesn't work, I go, why don't we try this? And I end up being more of a troubleshooter than anything else.
So you're drawing on your own acting career and experience somewhat.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a hard time, based on the amount of time I've spent on stage, in seeing how to fix something from an audience perspective. So a lot of times I'll have to walk up with them and be in their space to figure out what it is that needs to happen in the space from their perspective, which I've never really had a director do that to me. So I don't know if it's allowed, but it happens.
If it works, it's allowed.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Lou, have you directed your own work before?
I've directed, back in Philadelphia, I directed some productions with adult actors for kids. I ran a children's theater in Philadelphia, a group called Comedy for Kids. And we used adult professional actors, did stuff for kids, and I directed a handful of those. It's a very different process than writing. And I love being there watching Karen work with the actors, because I've never seen that kind of rigorous probing of the material, trying to find the truth in every moment of the show. Now, the show, it's Beer Can Raft is funny. It's, I hope, moving. It's a variety of things that I hope are very human. And bringing out the humanity in this. One of the things that we were just talking about this the other day that sort of allowed me to write it after years of struggling with some theater writing was to leave room for the actors. It finally dawned on me as a playwright that I needed to leave room for the actors. And what disappoints me a lot on stage is work that feels like the writer had everything under their control and wanted to control everything and didn't leave room for the actors to bring life to it. Now, the playwright's the architect. You know, the actors have to build the building and the director. And seeing what gets built in this just makes it incredibly exciting. I'm just thrilled at rehearsals.
You have to put your ego aside to do what you just, to accomplish what you just described, though.
Well, or you have to be able to say, you know,
that might have been a better idea than what I had.
Oh, yeah, it's a much better
occasion,
idea.
You know?
Cool, let's do it that way.
Or maybe it's not working because I didn't write it as well as it could be. Sometimes my instinct is the complete opposite. If I say something not quite working, I want to tear in and rewrite it.
Which we deliberately kept him out of the process for a while because I was afraid of that. Because I personally am of the perspective that the playwright is God and you make it work. It's your job to make it work. And it often has bothered me when a playwright is too involved early on in the process, that before an actor and a director has had an opportunity to actually really try to make it work, they go changing it when it might be fine. It might be us, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So.
And another thing that was special about this process that I really respected Karen for, she didn't want to do a, okay, we'll rehearse it for 2.5-3 weeks before we open, and then we'll be ready to go. As soon as she knew that she was going to direct it and produce it, she gathered the actors. And this was 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Had readings with them, had a couple rehearsals with them, and then set them off to learn the script, and then brought them back. So they had lived with these characters for months instead of weeks. And I'm seeing that really have an impact on their performances.
Which is harder, finding the touching, poignant, bringing out the humanity moments, or figuring out how to make the humor work?
I think they're the same thing.
Really?
I believe they're the same thing. I think if you don't buy the humor in a scene, whether it's in a movie or TV, if the humor seems like this is a joke line.
Did you say humor?
Yeah, I think it's.
Do you say humor?
Yeah, sometimes,
it's
not too often.
It's an East Coast thing.
Is it?
Yeah.
There's an H in that
Can't
word.
Can't get rid of humor.
He says hubris too. Yeah. Don't
really?
Worry about it.
But I don't draw the lines. Just give me a glass of water.
All the girls in the room, let's beat up on Luke.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Manishtana. Anyway, the what the heck was I saying? I have no idea.
You're talking about the humor.
Point is, I was asking which is harder to, as a director, as a writer, as an ensemble, because what you're describing is a very collaborative
but
process.
But to me, it's like, I think it's the kind of show, and the kind of thing I like to write are things where the audience isn't necessarily laughing at all the same moments, and they're not necessarily moved to tears at all the same moments. You know, I think human beings are richer than that.
You said human. I shouldn't be here, should I? I'm just disrupting things.
You know that thing you said about the playwright is God?
Right, right.
I think you've gotten past
well,
that.
Well, I have
gotten
to change.
Way past that.
I have to start dropping my H's now.
There we go.
As dictated.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you both to tell me a little bit about plot points. What's going on? Let's talk about the piece that gives the smaller piece that gives the work its overall title, Beer Can Raft. Why are we building a beer can raft?
Well,
is it something that can be explained?
As the curtain rises.
The beer can raft in the first piece is also utilized in the others as our major set piece.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And actually, this probably doesn't answer your question at all about what I was going to say.
That's okay. Keep going. I'm intrigued.
The process of building this beer can raft has been one of the more interesting things that I've ever done in my life.
They don't teach you that at theater school.
Where do you find enough empty beer cans, since clearly you can't actually function and empty them all on your own? It's already got over 500 beer cans.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the day that we floated it for publicity shots will forever be ingrained in my mind.
Where'd you float it?
White River off in the Broderable Park.
Okay.
On the dock thing that goes in. I told the actors we're going to float it. I've got a photographer and a videographer coming, and you guys are going to go out on the raft. And they said, okay, so you've tested it. It floats. And I was like, no.
White River isn't very deep there.
Right. And theoretically, it works. Theoretically, it completely should float. I'm not an engineer, and I've deliberately not solicited the advice of one, because I figured our publicity shots would be genius either way. If it sinks, and that's all I'm concerned about.
You will see it floating on a flatbed up and down Mass Avenue on a regular basis.
Right.
During the Fringe Fest. No, beer can wrap, just to give you an anchoring point. As
you
we
did
open.
Not. Say anchoring point.
Okay.
Good Lord. You can't
unfortunately,
turn up,
it's
can you?
Not anchored. That's part of the
okay,
problem. Three
it.
College students who were at a third-rate spring break resort went out to test their beer can raft one night for the beer can raft race that was happening the next day, and they maybe imbibed a little too much and were a little too distracted and kind of fell asleep on it. And as we wake up, they are in the middle of the ocean.
Ooh.
Floating on a beer can raft.
Cool.
Three people who, have various degrees of interest in each other. And I can just tell you, it ain't Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat.
Or Ship of Fools.
Or
I'm
Ship
guessing.
Of Fools. Well, you may qualify it as that.
And they're probably not well provisioned because they weren't anticipating.
They got nothing.
In the middle of the ocean.
So it's, but it's more, it sort of opens the door to characters sort of wrestling with fate versus randomness and how we end up connected to the people we end up connected to and things like that.
That brings me to, is any of this material autobiographical for either of you? Karen, I realize you're the director, not the writer, but how did you
Somehow he wrote about my life in the beer camp. No.
And I don't mean at that level. I mean, I'm guessing neither of you built a beer can raft in school, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, not in that. There are, I mean, I think any writer draws on their life or their attitudes toward things. There have to be.
I see reflections of Lou in this piece, the degree to which, you know.
Yeah, we have, and that's one thing we deliberately didn't discuss. Right. We deliberately haven't discussed factual basis for any of the moments in the play,
right.
any
it's
of
not
the
helpful.
Characters in the
right.
play.
It doesn't inform
it doesn't
anything.
Matter. No.
The play has to work whether you've, you know, whether you know me or not.
Right, exactly.
Has there been any material that your actors have said, I have no experience of this, I'm not figuring out, help me get there?
The actors have not said it because they're lovely, quiet, professional actors that refuse to admit defeat. However, I have picked up on some issues with that. And actually, our only real rewrite just happened based on that very problem.
One of the pieces had some references to a lot of 1970s illness of the week TV movies.
And
as we were rehearsing,
some of your folks weren't born yet.
And going into it, we realized these people weren't
I
ideas.
I wasn't born yet.
and it seemed just not quite right for this character to be talking about these, even if you accepted that chunk of it as a period piece. It was just uncomfortable and difficult. So I happily rewrote a small piece of it.
That's the beauty of working with a contemporary playwright.
Right.
You can't
right.
really do that with Arthur Miller.
Right.
Well, you have to figure out what works. You know, that's sort of what it's all about.
How do you hope to feel at the end of Fringe about this project?
Wealthy.
Beyond Lou's wildest dreams of avarice.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things I walked into this with Lou and the actors is oftentimes I'm disappointed when the rehearsal process is finished and things become
immovable.
Yeah. I don't necessarily believe in that, you know, as an actor, but you know, you lose your director and this is the show and this is how the show goes and you still discover things the whole time, but it doesn't necessarily integrate itself into any like group rehearse process. When Diane and I did, Diane Conrad and I did A&A, because it was just the two of us, we worked the show every day based on the audience and the reactions and so what can we do about this moment or how can we make this work better? Mm-hmm. And it constantly was growing in a rehearsal type way. Mm-hmm. So I informed everyone immediately when they were cast. I said, I hope no one objects because this show isn't done rehearsing until 24 hours after we close. And that way it gets to be something that is ever evolving through all of us. And so when it's finished, hopefully there will be something cohesive that other people can produce.
Yeah, that's a great gift to you as a writer.
Absolutely. And we can all share a beer without needing the can.
And we'll be auctioning off the raft as a piece of contemporary art.
Awesome.
Bidding starts at around something.
Where does that wildest dreams of avarice bottom line reside?
That could
What's
be.
The dollar amount?
meeting our production costs.
Exactly.
Sharon Gamble with Lou Harry and Karen Irwin. Find out more about Beer Can Raft and other Fringe shows at indiefringe.org. The Indie Fringe Festival starts this weekend and runs through Sunday, August 28th. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Well, we just had two interviews with you chatting about Indie Fringe.
It's Fringe time.
There's something like, what, another 260-some shows going on at Fringe besides the ones you just talked
about? Exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of good Fringe going on. Okay, well, each one maybe has five or six performances. So, if you take out those, about 230, 40
shows. I was told
there'd
be no math involved on today's calendar that
we call What Will We Do? But there are other things. Now, Fringe is great, and I can't wait to get down and see some more Fringe stuff. But besides Fringe, there are other things going on. What do you got?
There are indeed, and I want you to put this on your calendar right now because this was so wildly popular last year that you're going to want to make sure you are among the first in line FoodCon. It's an unconventional convention and first of its kind showcase and exploration of the art of culture and food in Indianapolis. Well, the first of its kind was a year ago, and it attracted more than 2,000 attendees on the first Friday of September. So they're doing it again at the Harrison Center Friday, September 2nd from 5 to 9. This year's FoodCon is built around the concept of biomes, and you can move through different kinds of environments, desert, prairie, wetlands, forest, tundra, and look at art as it interprets the local food movement.
Wow, that sounds great.
Know,
all at the
really
Harrison
intriguing.
Center. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Hey, want to give you a heads up that Orange is having their final peel party of the season. what am I talking about? Well, Orange, of course, is the great, really cool event that takes place on September 17th this year, and it's always an awesome party with artists and music acts and enviro lounges and film and beverage and all types of cool things. And in fact, we'll have a chat with those guys when we're at Penrod, but they do these peel parties that are sort of these preview parties, and they're having one Saturday night at the Monkey's Tail in Broad Ripple, and it's featuring performances by a whole bunch of different DJs and other musicians, and a live art exhibition with Mike Altman, and there's also going to be a whole bunch of Upland Brewing and Flat 12 and all types of fun stuff. Starts at 9 o'clock, 21 and over. It's the last Peel Party, Peel the Orange.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love
Saturday
that.
Night.
Hey, moving away from food-related themes, you're going to hear about this in the last interview on our show, but about 500 garden writers and people like them are descending on Indianapolis the 26th through the 29th. They're staying in downtown Indy, so if you see people who are wearing green, maybe they have grubby hands, you know, okay, that's a stereotype. But anyway, make them welcome. If you see people downtown who look like they're looking for directions, help them out, because we're a friendly kind of town.
Hey, if you missed some of the 48-hour film project screenings of all the movies that took place, this is the project with Big Car Gallery. Well, they are having a Best of Indy screening of the 48-hour film project on Thursday, October 25th, 8 p.m. at the Big Car Gallery. That's sort of above the Murphy Center in Fountain Square. Definitely worth checking out.
Hey, if you haven't had a chance yet, maybe you didn't get to any of the sneak previews or the big gala at the new Tarkington Theater up at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, here are reasons to go. Civic has just announced its 2011-2012 educational program, and it includes junior civic programs like Making Faces, a mask workshop, the Youth Singing Actor, Musical Theater Saturdays, but also some classes and workshops for adults, including private vocal coaching and piano lessons, jazz, tap, ballet, and musical theater dance, senior citizens classes, and much, much more. And you can find out more at Civic Theater's website.
Cool. Last thing I have time for, if you're a big fan of John Prine, or maybe of Prine, a tribute concert, which was created by the Phoenix Theater's Brian Fonseca, and maybe you saw it there, or perhaps you missed it and want to see it again, or see it now, it's up at the Carmel Community Players. They are performing it August 25th through the 28th at the Carmel Community Playhouse. Prine, a tribute concert. We'll be back next week with more of
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The Art of the Matter's resident gardener, Sharon Gamble, was intrigued to learn that Indianapolis will show off its garden powers and prowess to writers from around the country later this month when we host the Garden Writers Association annual symposium, portions of which are open to the public. Sharon invited Indy's gardener about town, Joellen Myers Sharp, and the Indianapolis Museum of Art's Lilly Director of Old Fields and Horticulture, Mark Zalonis, to tell her about why Indy should be proud of its gardening culture and heritage.
It's a little bit of a coup to be able to host this conference, I gather. Yes?
I would say so. I think Joellen went out a limb, horticulturally speaking,
to invite these.
I surely did. Saving that one. But to invite these folks here, because quite often it's always thought of, let's get the biggest cities to in regions to do that, and it, trying to follow up on places like Philadelphia and Seattle
and Dallas
or whatever.
Right, Portland. And...
Right, but this is a major coup, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mark, do you go every year?
I've been a member for about 4 or 5 years, and this will be my third meeting.
Mm-hmm. And Joellen, you try to go every year.
I think I've been to about 15 meetings.
What?
But you're a member of the board.
I am. Yes, I am a director. I represent Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio.
What is it that a city that's hosting this conference wants to do to show itself off, to show what's unusual about it, what's unique about it? What is your goal in having us be the host?
Boy, like with a lot of organizations that bring people here, everyone seems to find Indianapolis a pleasant surprise, and for all sorts of reasons, because it's clean, it's relatively safe, all sorts of very positive things. And as Joellen and I know, and a lot of our colleagues, we have a great heritage here of gardening because of the folks who emigrated here and settled down. There's just a great tradition, particularly down on the southwest side, where a lot of folks of German descent mm-hmm. came and set up greenhouses and nurseries and things, but it spread to places that they would recreate at the city parks, the boulevard systems,
right.
which don't necessarily have to be there, but somebody had the foresight to do that. And then there were private estates, not like there might have been in Newport or on the Gold Coast of Long Island, but still we have some very, mm-hmm. very nice estates that are now open to the public in various ways.
And I think the other thing that sort of sets us apart from other groups coming here is that we don't spend the whole time indoors. I mean, we are out. We call the garden tours story tours because they prompt articles about the city, about maybe particular garden bed that people saw or took photos of, because they're photographers, radio people, authors, all those folks belong. So half the day is usually spent in workshops and seminars and programs, and then the other half of the day we're on the road visiting private garden, mostly private gardens and some public gardens.
How do you do that? Do you rent buses or
yes.
people on the, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you have, probably have people on buses preparing people for what they're about
we
to
do.
See.
We have bus captains. They're the bus czars or whatever, you know. They're the ones who keep everybody running on time. I actually met with the Master Gardeners. The Marion County Master Gardeners are serving as bus captains, and I met with them yesterday, kind of went over duties and expectations.
What is it? Tell me a little bit more. You just mentioned a lot of our German immigrants, we were so good at buying into the propaganda programs in World Wars I and II. A lot of people don't know about the German heritage in Indianapolis. But who are some of the other forefathers or sort of garden godmothers and godfathers who created, I'm going to make the pun too, yeah. the landscape we have today? I'm sorry, you just can't help it.
No, that's good. I like that. well, we're blessed, I think. Again, most people wouldn't know that Indianapolis has had the services of several major designers that, you know, have also graced other mm-hmm. parts of the country. But nobody, including myself when I came here 14 years ago, would have thought that most of the major designers had been here.
Starting with George Kessler.
George Kessler.
Now, let's talk about I can't imagine how many people drive across Kessler Boulevard every day and have no idea who George Kessler
right.
was.
And a lot of the other boulevards that he designed and
well,
ending
all
up
of
in places
the,
like
most of the
Garfield
boulevards
park.
In the Indianapolis park system, like Riverside Boulevard, Pleasant Run Boulevard.
Fall Creek,
all of those were designed specifically because of the views that they offered the passersby. Or just the total ambiance of having that creek or that body of water to be able to enjoy that from the road. And so all of those boulevards in the park system are on the National Register of Historic Places. It's the largest registration on the National Register, right. our Indy Park system
really?
Is, yes.
That was an amazing coup itself.
It was, yes. I mean, and, you know, he was, besides the boulevards, I mean, he's responsible for the Sunken Garden at Garfield Park. And he also is responsible for Brendanwood, which was one of the first urban designed planned properties in the country.
How did we lure him here? Do we know that?
I think the Vonnegut's.
Probably so. Probably the Vonneguts.
The Vonneguts brought him here.
And he worked in other parts of the country in Kansas City, but he also worked in other parts of the state.
And he interned with the
Fort
Olmsteds.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought there was a
direct the Olmsteds
there.
Were here too, including.
It was a very small group then.
Right. And they were all interconnected. This is right at the very beginning of the American Society of Landscape Architects. Frederick Law Olmsted had been here to design Riverside Park, but later on some of his progeny came out, including Percival Gallagher, who did the lovely landscape at Old Fields, which is the part of the IMA, Indianapolis Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. He also worked down in Bloomington. What was called Dunn's Woods, now called the Old Crescent, that quadrangle that's formed by a number of buildings. He laid out all those pathways in that system as well. He also did a garden right here in Indianapolis where IUPUI now sits, and that's, I think, being restored as well.
Right, near the Old Ball Residence. So it's really on the old part of the campus. Hmm. And that garden was never completed, actually.
Right,
but
right.
They have the original drawings, and there's an effort underway to try to bring that garden into fruition.
Oh, that's great.
And then Jens Jensen, who was a Danish-born landscape architect who operated mainly out of the Chicago area, but very well known for his naturalistic landscapes, came here to work at a couple of places, but in particular the Allison Mansion, or Riverdale, where Marion University now sits. And it's just a wonderful estate of all sorts of natural features, mm-hmm. a lot of stonework, much of which has been brought back to life, some of it which now is part of the Ecolab that they're very proud of, and rightfully so. So he did projects there, and folks on tour will actually mm-hmm. get to see some of the private places that
he did.
Two of the very special private gardens in the city will be on tour. So people who are on those tours will get to see some things which a lot of our local people mm-hmm. have not yet seen. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, we've just opened up a property that was designed by Dan Kiley, another one of the preeminent landscape architects of the 20th century, who designed the Miller Gardens, Miller House property down in Columbus. And when we were formulating our prime list a couple of years ago, we didn't know who would end up with that property. But as you know, the Indianapolis Museum of Art is now the very proud owner. And that's now open for viewing, as you know, starting back in May. So we have the luminaries of landscape design having worked here in Indiana, and we're hoping to showcase that through our tours and through the talk that I'll be doing one of those days.
It sounds as though the list is so long that you had to really do some culling and figure out how to shorten the list.
You mean in terms of the garden tours?
Yeah.
Yes, we did. And the real draw for most garden writers is the ability to get into the private gardens. Because the public gardens, they can pretty much go to, you know, whenever they're in town. There are always some, of course, that, like at the Indianapolis Museum of Art or Garfield Park, where we want to make sure that they actually get to see these little jewels, as we call them. So, yeah, I mean, we and Irvin ATN, fast Irvin's muster, it would work for the rest
right.
of us.
How, for people who are maybe amateur gardeners sitting at home listening to this going, wait, I'm not part of the Garden Writers Association. I want to see some of this. How can I get involved? There are some events that are open to the public, yes?
Well, there is a day rate that you can come to the conference. So, and that's available at gardenwriters.org. They can find out about that meeting. If they're just interested in what we're going to be doing here, they can visit gardenwritersindy2011.info, and we update pretty continuously all the things that we're doing, what the committee's doing, and what the other garden writers are doing here.
Yeah, there's quite a blog going on there. There's rich content, I think,
right.
is
and,
the way to
we
describe
had a
it.
Local artist, Karen Kennedy, who did the logo for us, which was very nice. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's volunteering, so, I mean, there's no paid positions in any of this.
No, this is just local folks who love to show off the attributes of the city. It's something we're very proud of, and with this group in particular, who are all garden communicators who would appreciate this, but then also in a position to spread the word.
And a lot of them are travel writers. Mm. So, you know, they'll be able to tap into some of the great resources that we have in this community for tourists also. And we have our tote bags are made out of remnants of the Hoosier Dome. So that's pretty unusual. You know, that's something you could only get in Indianapolis, would be a tote bag made out of Hoosier Doe material.
I love that.
And that's part of our attempts to be as sustainable and green as possible,
right?
Not only the organization, but the conference itself.
Right.
Trying to eliminate the need for plastic water bottles and all sorts of other things. But I don't know if that was your idea about the bags, but whoever.
No, it worked out.
It worked out
yes, it did.
Well. It's very exciting. A lot of work to get to that point, but it's something they will never get anywhere else.
No, and the public can also sort of take advantage of our being here and seeing some of the gardens that we're touring just by going on garden tours in their own neighborhood or in their own communities. I mean, several neighborhoods have their own garden tours. Usually in June is the prime month for that.
Before the drought settles in.
Right. And then as garden communicators, you know, just reading our articles and listening to our radio programs, we try to share all of the information we learn at a conference like this with our readers, viewers, and listeners.
It strikes me, and you talked about the importance of volunteering and the vast number of volunteer hours and brain power going into this. Gardeners tend to be a very generous sort.
I would agree.
I would too. I tell people that all the time. If they're not, you know, they're sharing their produce, they're cutting flowers for you, or they're dividing their plants for you, or they're sharing their seeds.
And they're pretty
bold
too.
Wisdom.
You know, living in the village of Zionsville where I do, it's not unheard of that somebody will just look over the fence to see what I have growing there in the last, you know, do you have enough that I could give me a little piece of that action?
That plant, you know?
and they sort of hinter around until you say, well, sure, I'll dig one up at the appropriate time and get it to you. And it's just a nice way to spread the spread the wealth, because we all enjoy what we do. We enjoy growing what we do and want to share in that enjoyment.
Right.
Sharon Gamble with Joellen Myers Sharp and Mark Zalonis. The Garden Writers Association Annual Symposium is from August 25th through the 30th. You can find out more and find out about those day passes for non-members at gardenwriters.org. Again, gardenwriters.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when I'll get a preview of the Fountain Square Art Fair.
I'll take a look at the two nights of dance being presented by this year's Indianapolis City Ballet.
And I'll get the lowdown on Start with Art and the new murals project. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call What do we do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Summer at the Palladium, now through August. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.